Let's try this again. Hello, welcome to TechEd 2013. My God, we're getting old. My name is Uli Hohmann, or Ulrich as the official name says. I'm the chief architect for the consulting organization, which officially is named Worldwide Enterprise Services, but I think everybody knows it as Microsoft Consulting Services. And I'm here to demystify devices and services, although I actually describe the outcome rather than the activity, because when you hopefully get out of here, you get an idea of what we as a company mean when we do this devices and services statement. Because Steve Ballmer, when he said that we are now a devices and services company, he kind of said it, put a point behind the whole thing, and then he moved on. He didn't really tell us what that means, and he didn't really have a memo that says, when we talk about a devices and services company, here's what these things are. And I have 22,000 people that work with me worldwide, and they kind of are very creative. And they, when they hear something like that, a fundamental statement, they kind of make stuff up. They go to their customers and saying, based upon whatever the customer need is, that's a devices and services strategy. And so we, as the service organization, really didn't want that to happen and put together a program that talked about, okay, how do we think about devices and services? And we went to 16, 17 different product groups, ranging from the Visual Studio guys to the Skype guys, Windows client, everybody, and said, what's your view of devices and services? And we put together a hopefully pretty comprehensive picture for you of what that really means. Devices and services, as we will talk about from here, is primarily about applications. We're not going to talk about surface hardware or device hardware. Lots of sessions about that in terms of what is devices in terms from a hardware or mobility experience, but this is really about applications. This is about applications that span n number of devices, different types, and are connected to services. If that's not the session you're expecting, please keep that in mind when you're listening as part of this, as we are not going to talk about device hardware or operating system features and so forth. Why is everybody so excited about devices? When you look at numbers, our friends from Cisco put this together, and you can take it with a grain of salt because 2020 is quite a ways away. Remember, 5 years ago, we didn't have the thing called Samsung Galaxy. So from that perspective, 2020 is a long way. But the projection currently is that we have 50 billion devices. Currently, thinking that we will have those. And devices, in this case, are not just things that you have a user interface on it and a Windows, Android, or Apple operating system. They will have other things there as well. They might not have a user interface. And we will see some of the scenarios that we actually have seen in our discussions with customers worldwide, ranging from car companies to our friends at GE, medical, and GE field engineering. And you will see a bunch of interesting things, I hope, that will trigger your imagination of what we believe devices and services are all about. And this number here gets a lot of people really excited. And when you look at the investments Microsoft is making, those are targeted at that number, ranging from the Windows operating environment all the way to Windows embedded and other environments in the automotive space and so forth that we have seen. Again, the other piece that's really fascinating about devices and services, not that that was really something that we didn't do before, is that the entire spectrum of services and integration between how you think about the device and how you think about the back-end services are being thought about. When you listen to Brad this morning, he talked about the CloudOS again, and he talked about the various pillars. If you go to the trade floor, you will see that we'll talk about the modern data center, not that much of interest in this case here. But we will talk about people-centric IT, we will talk about big data, and it's all about the data, and we will talk about modern applications. And when you look at the back end here, there is a heck of a lot of services that people are investing in, and they're investing in to project them to services or as services to devices, ranging from the little light switch that we are going to see, a smart light switch, all the way back to big end machines that we have seen customers are looking at that are in itself $500 million machines, but that are getting hampered or disabled by a $5 part. And so people are really interested in predicting when is this $5 part going to fail in order to drive forward. So that device doesn't have to be small or even a Windows device. It could be a very complex environment that will get supported by a big data environment to support analytics for preventive maintenance and so forth. And we will see some more of those kind of examples. Why, again, are people so excited? Yes, it's all about interesting new user scenarios, but it's also about big money. Just saving a little bit on every scenario, like, for example, in the fuel savings for aviations. If we can manage to save 1%, that's a $30 billion savings over 15 years. And that's really what this devices and services concept from a end-to-end architecture is all about. On the one side, creating new scenarios that we haven't seen before, but on the other side, figuring out how can we save money driving intelligence both into the device environment as well as into the backend environment and create a closed loop between those devices and services. I hope that some of you have seen this picture. This is the marketecture, I would call it. It's not an architecture picture, but a marketecture that really looks at the Microsoft investments. And we are investing in the connected devices and device applications across the spectrum, both, of course, on the Windows side, but you will see more and more HTML5 emerging and support for other things, iOS and Android and so forth. You will see a big social component as part of this devices and services environment, and we will talk about social quite a lot because it is interesting, not just from a Yammer perspective or Facebook or Twitter, but how do you integrate your devices, apps, and services into that world? And why would you want to do that? And then we will talk about service APIs. If you haven't signed up for any of the web API sessions that are out here, OData, OpenGraph, and OAuth, those are three of the key standards that we're investing in as Microsoft and the industry to really make this devices and services environment work for a number of scenarios. Unified management, again, Brad did a good job today talking about System Center and Azure and all this, how that works. We did the announcement around support for an open management, mobile management environment so that you can manage mobile environments much easier. So there is a lot of interesting movement here, and of course, do this across on-premise environments and public cloud environments, although some of the investments are better suited for public cloud environments, especially when you think about millions of or billions of devices. I've seen some CIOs talk to me where they got really worried that the always-on generation, or you could also call it the ADD generation, would continue to hit their synchronization button 7x24 with an unknown number of load against the back end. And so thinking through how you want to do that and how you want to manage the load is something that the public cloud infrastructure might be better suited for. One of the key things that I keep telling my people, and I hope that you take away from here as well, is that devices are not just the little phone thingies, the tablet thingies, pads, laptops, and so forth. They are anything that you can put some intelligence on. And some of the intelligence might actually just be a life sign, and you have a controller system in the back that effectively allows you to communicate with an array of sensors, and that then gets aggregated into something smart. For example, oil and gas systems work like that, where the probe that is going down is effectively just a sensor that sends information back, and on top you have a controller that understands the sensor information, then that's the device in quotes. And you have devices that actually don't have a user interface. Sometimes they don't even really have an operating system. You can send some pulses to this thing, and that's it. So the device range is really, really, really wide, and it depends on your scenario, what you're most interested in. The other piece is that there is going to be storage variety in terms of how do you think about storage. Sometimes you have local storage, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have only very little, sometimes you have quite a lot. And your application architecture, deployment architecture, and so forth, really has to think through how you deal with that. And then the sexy part, sensors. When you think about new application types, the modern app, It is actually always a sensor-optimized or sensor-enabled application. It is something where you look at how do you change the way you do business with these device capabilities. One question that we are not going to talk about here, but I give you an idea how I think about this problem, is HTML5 versus native apps. It's a huge debate. Every customer I talk to around the globe tells me, ask me, what do I do? Do I build HTML5 apps or do I build native apps? And the answer, being a consultant, of course, that it depends. It depends on, are you willing or are you capable or are you envisioning a new business process where you change the way you think about the way the actual service is running, then you should think about a native app or maybe a hybrid app. If you really only want to project information and you want to don't change the way the business process works, don't even bother. HTML5 is perfect and works just fine. If you only want basic sensor information like geolocation and touch, HTML5 standard supports that as well. It's just getting when you're interested into the photo camera or into the accelerator meters or other capabilities that the system has, you have to think about native device integration rather than HTML5. And again, I'm sure the HTML guys will get there eventually as well. And that's when you look at this, it's something where, and I'll walk you through some scenarios, this is where we believe devices and services as an application opportunity is different than a normal application development discussion. We say, yep, I could build it on a phone or a pad or a desktop. That's one type. But once you get into really industrialized machines, if you think about our friends from Google with their glass environment, you will see a number of variations of device that we haven't really experienced or envisioned at this point in time. And we need to think about when we build applications, when we build services, how to deal with these capabilities and how to really utilize these capabilities. As I said before, I have 22,000 very, very interested and eager guys and ladies running around the globe. They make stuff up all the time because they want to serve their customers best. In order to help them, making sure that they're aligned with the corporate strategy and investments, we put together these principles. Being an architect, I generally start with principles before I do start coding, because I'm trying to put a framework in place of that guides me to say, this is what we are looking at. On the devices side, we assume that each device is a connected device. That does not mean that it's always connected, because that's one of the assumptions that is very much made in the US of A, where connectivity is great most of the time. But when you go out, even in a country like Germany, my home country, the Deutsche Telekom told me that until 2018, there is no plans for certain areas to get cell phone coverage in Germany, and that's not necessarily an undeveloped country. If you then go to rural India or China or Russia or any of these places, you will see that connectivity is not cheap, it's not plentiful, it might not be even there. So when you think connected, always think about connected most of the time. And when you truly say, I am always connected, you're limiting your capabilities, which is okay, but should be a conscious decision. And connectivity is one of those that we will talk a little bit more about. But our Windows 8 friends have done a really good job explaining the various capabilities of connectivity between 2G, 3G, 4G, LTE, and so forth, and how you can deal with the transitions between the capabilities, because that's really the app's responsibility to understand the connectivity environment. The next one is a pet peeve of mine and certainly something that the Windows 8 guys are also pushing very, very hard. I don't know about you, but I'm the IT administrator for my wife at home. She doesn't like computers, she really hates that thing, and I'm really afraid right now because it's a Windows 7 machine that I've upgraded, I've had it now for 8 years. It's upgraded from XP to 7 and so forth. And now I'm thinking about buying her a new computer and getting Windows 8 on it and on so forth. There's a lot of state on that machine that's only on that machine. There is no way I can just say, rebuild the machine, log in with her Hotmail account, and everything comes down to me. Because the application developers, wrote a whole bunch of stuff into the registry, into the local file system that's not backed up, and. And so the assumption that we are now making, and that's something that we certainly see as part of the devices and services world, is that the loss of the device is a non-event. It should never be a problem. Yes, there will be transitory stages, possibly, if you have a disconnected device and that crashes, you lose some data between the last synchronization time and so forth. When you look at the push that we are making with respect to SkyDrive and other things, that's really an implementation of that principle. And it is a really important principle because people expect, just from a user perspective, I don't want to think about this. I want to buy a new device, log on, and everything comes to me. Last time I checked it, and so forth. And Windows 8 does a pretty good job. It's not perfect yet, but certainly it is much, much better than what we did before. And again, always with best intentions, so I'm not bashing my Windows friends, but it's certainly something that I think as a principle, I'm certainly looking at my people when they write code. Are you making sure that that code saves data into the cloud? And again, Windows 8 has done some great job educating people how to do that and what the storage architectures are and so forth. Again, the device state ought to be saved into the cloud. Now, a lot of you most likely will say, well, we don't do public cloud, we only do private cloud, which means you can take advantage of some of the built-in features because SkyDrive at this point in time is only a public cloud service, but you can still, of course, override your own applications to store wherever they need to store because it's just a REST-based API at the end of the day. And we are not demanding that you need to absolutely store on SkyDrive. We're just telling you, save the state somewhere where it's safe. If you want to save apps and user state separately, that's something that the app design will require or will talk about. But it's certainly something, from my perspective, app state and user state should be separated because the apps most likely will be used by multiple users. And again, the app and user state is transparently available across devices. The common scenario that we are seeing is retail. I don't know if I work like this, but a lot of people seem to operate like this, where they start at home on a web browser and they start browsing for things. Then they get into the car and they would like to see the same session state on their device in the car. And then when they get into the office, they would like to continue working across those transitions. And again, for the user scenario, for a home user, I don't know. Some people find it attractive, but I'm sure you can see a lot of business scenarios where a person that starts scheduling work in the field sits at his office desktop, then he would like to take all that stuff onto his pad. And then when he goes to the customer, he uses his glasses to get the same state based upon his schedule and so forth. So this whole transitory state is really about moving things around. Because that's the other premise that's behind devices and services. Everything and everybody is mobile. This stationary desktop thing still exists. I actually just got a new one. But I always have two other devices, a Surface RT and my phone with me, so that whenever I need to go, I just pack it up and move. I don't have a Pro. I don't need it right now because I can still access my desktop if I need to run Visual Studio, which is really the only thing that I run that doesn't run on the RT. And again, the last one we already talked about before, but as a principle, a device does not have to have a user interface, or any of these kind of things that you assume when we talk about devices and services, because most of devices and services talks about either Windows devices or Android or Apple devices. While that is clearly the majority of what we talk about, it is not the majority of the 50 billion that we talked about before. That will be different, and they might not have user interfaces or even users. That's why another reason why apps and users ought to be separated, because they might not be the same. Here on the plus side, again, we try to be cute to make it memorable because people generally tend to remember monikers. We on the plus side, we kind of look at three big buckets. The connectivity buckets, I'm putting flippantly here, Windows 8 network guidance. If you haven't looked at the Windows Developer Center, even if you're an Android person or an Apple person, these guys have done a real good job talking about meter connections, talking about the transitions between the various broadbands and Wi-Fi and all this other stuff and how you detect it using Windows. And you can easily apply that across the device spectrum for other operating systems. It's done a really good job. And connectivity here, we're only talking about the physical connectivity, the network in itself. But make no mistake, assuming very high-end connectivity like LTE or Wi-Fi is just limiting the applicability of your apps in whatever device scenario you're looking for. Because it is not given that we have connectivity the same way everywhere. Good news is we have standards that encapsulate the variability, so you don't have to worry about, is this thing going from 2G to 4G? You just have to worry about the capabilities. Two things that are really important, identity. We will talk a lot more about identity in terms of what the standards are that we are thinking about. But throughout my travels in the world, I really have found a lot of companies that are still not clear about their identity strategy. What is it that you're going to do? If you have non-enterprise users coming into your enterprise, what's your strategy? Are you federating? With what are you federating? Do you trust consumer identities like Facebook or Microsoft or Google ID, or do you not? And again, it's not a question of what is right or wrong. It's a question of, do you have a strategy? Do you know what you're pushing for and how you're going to enforce it? That is something that I would believe is step one if you go into a devices and services scenario that includes users that are possibly not your end users. And again, we will talk about some standards and some implementation ideas, but that's certainly something to think about. The other piece that we stress here is this, as devices can not necessarily have a user identity, and we are also seeing that actually services and devices need to interact between themselves, you need to think about how you work with devices and have their identity participate in an application scenario. How many of you use Xbox at home? How many of you use Netflix on Xbox? Remember the little dance you had to go through to register the Xbox with Netflix so that effectively the Xbox could access on your behalf the Netflix services? That's what this is all about. And there's very good guidance available of how you effectively create delegated identity so that your device can actually access services on your behalf if you want to allow that. And again, the other piece that you see when you use Windows 8 or Windows Phone 8 and Apple and Android, you actually will be asked to give the apps certain rights, access the sensors, access the local storage, et cetera, et cetera. That's the other aspect of this where you can say, no. Based upon my identity, based upon my app, this is what I require, and the user has to grant these rights to the application. And again, that's a common theme that you will see more and more in devices and services, that the apps will act on your behalf, even if you're not logged in, and you need to authorize it, and so forth. And then integration. Data integration, relatively simple, except, of course, that you need to think about caching. When we talk about always connected or almost always connected, you always have to think about, okay, how much data do I need to be able to continue working until I have connectivity again? And that varies. It could be very little data, or it could be a lot of data. And when you look at WinRT as a specific case, you will see that we actually have no Microsoft database on that WinRT environment today. So if you are used to using a database, in terms of SQL database, you need to use SQLite, for example, is a package that we have enabled for WinRT. But you don't necessarily need a full-scale database if you're okay with XML files and other things that you can cache locally in the file system. So the data piece is actually something where if you're always real-time, meaning I can always query, that's one model. You can always go back to the server, get some XML or JSON or some other format back, and off you go. But if you need to cache it, you've got to think about, is there a file storage available? Remember, devices don't necessarily have to have storage. They don't necessarily have to have the file system you expect, like a FAT or XFAT or NTFS or something like that. They might have something different. They might not have SQL capabilities, or they might, but you have to bring them along, and so forth. So data is not, in this case, something that is about your app. It's here about the capabilities that you need in order to keep working. Notifications is a very interesting topic. I hope if you're interested in this thing, there are three technologies that you should look at. ASP.NET SignalR, if you have not heard about it, very interesting project to support two-way WebSocket communication without necessarily depending on WebSockets. There are other ways of doing it, so it's an abstraction layer. Then there is Azure Mobile Services, and then there is Service Bus Notification Hubs. Those are the three technologies that I would look at in the notification space. SignalR is very important when you're thinking about app-to-app communication or app-to-service. The app talks to a service bidirectional, and it can effectively bypass the operating system notification channel because the app is live, the service is live, so they can talk to each other. Azure Mobile Services and the notification hub is important because sometimes the app might not be up and running. And so you want to push a notification from a service down to a device. All the device operating systems that are relevant, Windows, Android, and Apple, have notification platform services. And the Azure Mobile Services, as well as the notification hubs, target all three of those. So you as a service developer can just push a notification into one of these technologies, and it will effectively deliver it based upon identity and queries and rules to the target device. And I won't tell you which one to use because, again, it depends. Windows Azure Mobile Services is very, very fast in terms of productivity, getting things going. At this point in time, as an enterprise security model, we still have work to do. Whereas the notification hubs are based upon the service bus, so very robust capability, nice integration into the ACS or Azure Active Directory environment, but it's not quite as productive in terms of and fast from a development perspective as Azure Mobile Services. Good news is the notification hub people and the mobile services people are starting to work together and seeing how they can integrate and make the services work together. Good news is, any of you remember EAI, Enterprise Application Integration? A lot of the integration patterns that we are used to, PubSub and some of the other stuff that you've heard about, also apply in this mobile space. Because a lot of times you're thinking about, I want to burst a message from my service to thousands of devices or millions of devices. We know how to do that. And then the result is a little bit tougher, getting information back from millions of devices, so scatter, gather, and some of these other patterns that we have talked about in the EAI context become relevant in this space, again, just with some different technologies. And last but not least, our services model. Because when you think about devices and services, or apps and services, it's really the service that does a lot of the hard work. The application is really worried about working with the device, understanding the user, understanding the changing device conditions, connectivity just being one of them. And the service is doing a lot of the hard work, storing the data, interacting with the users, interacting with, for example, some other technologies like big data and so forth we talked about before. And so we have put together a set of simple principles. Services are designed with a cloud-first mindset. That does not mean that they are only running on Windows Azure or AWS. They simply follow the cloud-first mentality of how do you do elasticity, how do you do reliability, and so forth. And we have a series of guidance which is called fail-safe. So if you go to MSDN and query for fail-safe, you will find a series of both architecture guidance and implementation guidance for Windows Azure of what that means and how do you implement that stuff. RESTful APIs, using best practices. Again, we have provided a couple of guidance elements in the fail-safe environment of what that means, of what is a best practice for REST APIs. Because in the REST space, God bless them, they went very lightweight compared to WCF or the WSTAR people, which went very heavy. But you get a 404 error back, and it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. If you give me a service and you give me a service, they might have different interpretations of what a 404 is. And so some of these best practices are just common guidelines to say, when you say 404, this is what you mean. And when you say X, this is what you mean, because we don't have a SOAP fault element like we have in SOAP and so forth. So REST is the way to go. We completely are in line and agreed, but you got to think about some strategies. Even if you don't have them today, start thinking about what does a 404 mean, what are some other elements that you want to standardize across your services. So OData, Open Graph, and OAuth, I will talk about separately. Those are three standards that we push for every Microsoft service. So OData for sure, OAuth for sure, Open Graph is optional. And again, I'll talk about what Open Graph is and why we're using it. And then services are data-centric and or insight-enabled. We'll talk about what insight-enabled means in a sec. The other thing that I believe in is progression levels, because when you look at the entire space of the CloudOS mantra or marketing message, that's a lot of stuff to chew, because it talks about cloud enabling the thing, it talks about a modern application, the data integrated, social integrated, blah, blah, blah. Doing that all at once is a real tough job, because you've got to also build an app and set of services that do something interesting and are not just insight enabled. So on the zero level, which is the basic cloud or devices and services level, we talk about the app being the center of the world, but it's storing its state in the cloud. SkyDrive being the default location, but it could be any file share, Dropbox, whatever you like, where this application stores its state. Coming back to the principle that every device is a cache, and we are okay with losing the device because we are looking at the cloud to restore everything that we know about these applications. The second one, which is the majority of applications that we certainly have built as Microsoft services, is really about the device application, the data and settings are cached, notifications ideally are enabled, the live tiles, and then we're using Azure mobile services or using the service bus and are building service-specific RESTful APIs supporting standards like OData, OAuth. And then one or more services are being accessed, et cetera, et cetera. So nothing really earth-shattering on these two levels. The other two are more interesting. The second layer, and again, we could have picked the other way around, but we picked social-enabled as the next one. A modern application, as we stated in our marketing papers, is social-enabled. And then we stop. And social-enabled is something that we believe most applications that have a user interface will become that way. So let me give you an example. When you think about a CRM application and you're entering the sales order, wouldn't it be great if I could tell my team that I work with that I entered the sales order and what the progress of the sales order is? Well, but nobody wants to open the CRM app to find out. So when you look at social enabled, it actually means that the CRM application on behalf of the user will post updates of the sales order progress with the customer into, let's say, Yammer or Twitter or something else. So that the account team, the people that work, actually are enabled to understand what's going on. So that's the application pushing information into what the Yammer people so nicely call the social fabric. And the other side is the application consuming the graph of information. Let's say I have my friend Yuri here, and Yuri has posted on Yammer his preferences and his friends and so forth. And some of it is inferred because I understand his organizational graph, meaning who does he work for, what does his work team look like, and so forth. So I actually go into Yammer using Open Graph as an API and understand, based upon Yuri's preferences, how to customize my app, how to change my behavior to say, well, Yuri is really not interested in, I don't know, Yammer information because he's a Windows Server guy. So I'm not going to bother him with that information. I'm only going to target whatever information Yuri is really preferring to hear to him. So if you think about personalization, if you're thinking about targeting users and really giving the best experience you can think about, Open Graph is one of those APIs that allow you to reach into things like Facebook, Twitter, Yammer, to really understand what are the people's preferences, who do they work with, who do they work for, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the consuming side of a social enabled app. And we talked already about the integration into the social fabric as one of the other elements. And then insight enabled. So most of you will have heard about, read about big data. And we also know that we create data, lots of it. Well, actually, I don't know if we're creating lots of data. I'm sure we do, but I don't know if it's useful data. Is it data that we really can analyze, that we can understand how to work with? How many of your applications produce data outside of log files that the system creates for you? Outside of the data that you store in the database or into the file system or into the big data store, whatever you're putting it in, doesn't really matter. How many of your applications track information about the user's behavior while they are working in their app? Let me give you an example of what I mean with that. MSN.com, our portal on the internet, is effectively insight-enabled. What does that mean? They track every user click and every user query, because based upon that user query and user clicking, they establish a behavior pattern. And that behavior pattern is fed through an analysis environment that says, well, based upon this behavior pattern, we have seen this one before. We assume we are seeing a white male, 35 to 45 years, with this kind of demographics. So the insight analytics environment brings back the demographic model to the application. And the demographic application, or the application, then uses that demographic model to do something. Again, when you look at the most visible example, our friends from Amazon. When you look at Amazon's people who did this, who did that, that's effectively an insight-enabled application, because they are going to look at your behaviors, what you have purchased, but they're also going to take a look at what have you put into your shopping basket that you didn't buy. What are you actually taking out of the shopping basket? And how long did you hover around and put it into the basket? It took you 5 minutes to and put it back. From a retail perspective, that's the worst thing that can happen. So what they're trying to figure out is, how do I make sure that you put that stuff into the shopping basket and you convert it to a purchase? That's what insight-enabled applications are all about. And we will talk a little bit about how you effectively enable that and what that means. Because when I look at the future of applications is for sure a lot of user-oriented stuff will be social-enabled, but a lot of applications that are interesting will be here. They will start to really think about instrumentation from a business perspective that will be feeding an analytics environment, and that analytics environment will then interact with the app and tell the app what to do. And again, we have some examples of how that works. So we talked about the principles, we talked about progression levels, and originally we talked maturity levels, but I think the word progression is a little bit more realistic, because it's perfectly fine to have one of those or one of those, or pick one of the two. I've yet to see a single case where a single application does all of it, meaning they're social enabled, they're insight enabled, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't happen very often, and is certainly something that is very application specific. Although I do believe that this will become far more mainstream than what we are seeing today. Because big data without the integration into the app is somewhat boring, as we will later see. Talked about those three guys already. If you haven't looked at open data or OData, that's something to really consider as part of your API strategy for your services. It effectively is a metadata protocol on top of JSON. So if you know what JSON is, which is effectively the encoding of JavaScript data objects and the payload. And we effectively, Microsoft put a spec on top of it that allows tools and application environments, runtimes, to make sense of the data, because JSON is structured, but it's structured without necessarily forcing a structure or semantics. It's really hard to write tools and applications against it. OData puts a semantic layer on top of it that forces certain set of behaviors. So they tell you what a get and a put is, what a merge is, what a delete is, and so forth. If you don't know the rest verbs, start to brush up, because that's going to be, for lots of people, a new world where we have to start thinking. And it effectively allows people like us to build jQuery, Excel, SharePoint, other tools to consume possibly your data or have your data be consumed by those environments without you having to know upfront that actually I'm going to integrate with Excel. You could do that, obviously, but this is a much more loosely coupled way. SAP, IBM, all sorts of other people support OData. So if you're an SAP customer, for example, the SAP Gateway supports OData, and SAP HANA will support OData natively. So it will consume and produce OData by definition. IBM WebSphere does the same thing. The first piece, although, that I would invest in is OAuth. Open authentication in the version 2.0, OAuth, is the way Microsoft services are going to expect you providing identity and will provide you with authentication services. And it also deals with a delegation from one service. Let's say you pass it to SharePoint and SharePoint passes it to another service. OAuth is the way the identity flows from one service to the next across the value chain. It is really an important investment that we are making. And if you are investing in a devices and services landscape, in addition to an identity strategy, invest in OAuth, because that's the way the industry is going. And we are also standardizing as an industry on the JSON Web Token, JWT, as the encoding of that specific token. Again, .NET just released support for that in their version 4.5. So you can start working with that. And then Open Graph is the social integration into a set of services. If you are building Windows 8 client applications, you have another alternative. The People Hub, which is a very rich and sexy environment for Windows 8 environments, is effectively similar to Open Graph from an API perspective. But it allows you to interact locally with the People Hub, and you effectively get an abstraction across all of the social services that the user has aggregated under the People Hub. But that's, at this point in time, Windows 8 only, and only really when the user or if the user uses that kind of thing. Open Graph is something that is supported by Facebook, Twitter directly, Yammer directly, and so forth. Now, some of those I've already walked you through, but I kind of thought that it might be a good thing to see or share with you what we have seen in our executive briefing center in terms of what our customers are really thinking. What are other people looking at when they are saying devices and services, connected applications with continuous services? A lot of times we're seeing people looking at firmware and software delivery. So we had a very, very big a consumer electronics company with their TVs, which are smart TVs. So it's not our Samsung friends, but a similar one. And they are really struggling through, how do I deliver firmware updates, software updates, to all those smart devices, to these TVs? And so they're working with Windows Azure as a software update delivery. Intune is a little bit too heavy because it assumes this number of environment settings, although you could use a bunch of the Windows Intune or Windows Store mechanics to deliver that kind of software update. Inside delivery, and again, that is a number of scenarios where we have seen people just giving you information based upon your profile, your purchasing behavior, what you have shared with the user, sometimes via things like Amazon, sometimes via things like Twitter or Facebook, where they aggregate all that stuff and sending you information. I'm sure you're getting summaries if you're into LinkedIn. Every day or every other day, there's somebody sending you a mail saying, these things happened, new connections, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of the insight delivery. And again, you could do this as a notification, you could do this as an application, and or encoded as an email and so forth. Remote management, I'm sure a lot of you have seen some advertising from our friends, I think it was Nissan or Toyota, one of the car guys, where they're actually saying, what if your device controls your car? Where they actually start charging now, it's these big advertising for electronic cars. So we are seeing a lot of people are looking at devices to control other devices. In this case, a car or something more complex, or a home. A lot of home security scenarios are being looked at here as well. Device to infrastructure. I mentioned oil and gas, the little oil pipeline discussion, or the very big machines that are doing the fracking, and so forth. Those are effectively infrastructure. What we're also seeing discussions around the utility grid and so forth. Everybody is aware, I assume, of the smart grid that people are investing in. That's really what this is all about. How do you control and optimize the infrastructure that supports X, being a utility, for example, using a devices and services approach? And again, insight enablement is one of the key things that we are looking at. Geo-tracking, I think everybody of you is very well aware of what's going on. If you're looking at your phone and you're using things like Yelp, it will automatically constrain based upon where you are. Rather than showing you a pizza joint in New York, it will only show you what's around here. That's a common thing by now, and if you think about it, that's going to be an expected feature of any app that you're going to ship onto a smart enabled device. Media delivery and playback. I don't know if you are into that, but lots and lots of focus on that. How do you bring onto mobile devices media and have that streamed properly? Again, go back to the Windows 8 networking guidance of how to optimize for that. Metered connections, just to give you the warning. I did a call with my girlfriend over Skype while I was running around in Europe, and I thought, can't be that bad. All of a sudden, I got two SMS from AT&T that I had added another 120 megabytes for $30 to my little bill. So when you think about streaming and meter connections, that's something to be very aggressive about with users. Fitness and health. Most of you will know that our friends from Nike are now a software developer. Yeah, you know that there's a Nike SDK, right? If you don't, it's worth checking out because our friends from Nike are they started off with this connected shoe experience with the iPod and iPhone. And now they have the Fitbit stuff where they actually are using a device and services set of principles and architecture to really move information from your running experience all the way to the cloud. And I'm sure they're working on real-time information so that when things, let's say you're getting close to a heart attack, wouldn't it be nice if the system would tell you? Because it knows. I'm getting old, so I still think I'm 20, but unfortunately, my buddy tells me, you're not 20 anymore. So the assumption level has to be somewhat adjusted in terms of what you can do and so forth. So a lot of these smart technologies we're seeing in medical, fitness, and sports. Connected operations, mentioned this before. This is one of those expensive machines that actually dies when there is a $5 part that goes crazy. There's another very expensive tool called an airplane engine that has a similar thing, which costs $5. When that thing goes, the whole engine goes. And so there are a lot of connected operations where people are trying to do what's called preventive maintenance, to saying, this thing is about to go. And based upon the information we have seen, let's change the $5 part. The problem with the $5 part on the airplane engine and the big system here, they are so hidden that it takes a lot of work to get to that part. And so they don't want to do it every time they touch the machine, which you would say would be a normal thing to do, but the labor cost is very high. Connected vehicles for a number of things. I've talked to, I have no idea how many automotive vendors. They all are working on it in terms of telemetry from the car, giving you OnStar-like experiences, but with more features and capabilities because we can move more data around. We've also seen people looking at trucks and buses. And of course, you see a lot of interest in the media scenarios. So Audi has done a lot of work with Google, Google Maps and so forth. And there are other people that are working with Microsoft Bing and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Connected retail, again, one of the more scary scenarios was, there are two really cute ones. One, there was a retail guy that wanted to put a Kinect device into his opening doors, into his entry doors. And he wanted to actually start using the Kinect to recognize the people when they come in and start to give a personalized advertising experience throughout the store. Sounds familiar? Remember this Tom Cruise movie? That's kind of where we are going, where people are starting to personalize the store experience for you based upon device recognition and possibly the little handheld tracker called a phone that you carry with you. Because that's the second scenario. There is actually a retailer, I don't know which one, because it was one guy in the field that worked with him, which actually, if you opt in, they will actually figure out, you hover in front of the retail shelf too long, they'll send you a coupon for that specific product to effectively make you buy and then move on because you're kind of occupying space. Let's be naughty about that one. But the idea is that you use the device capabilities and the user's interest in doing stuff to effectively entice them to whatever behavior. And connected retail is another piece where on the consumer side, those are scenarios. And of course, what our friends Walmart started with RFID, that's just the beginning in terms of how you track the supply chain and how you optimize the supply chain with devices and services. That's going to become even more interesting because of the big data and the real-time analytics capabilities. So those are all scenarios that are not future. These are happening. This is what other customers are doing. I can't tell you the names of the customers, but they are all doing it in various forms. And so forth. So if you are working for an enterprise that hasn't really thought this through, now is the time because it is becoming real. I want to talk about these two as the rest of my talk goes on, and I need to talk faster, I guess. And I will start with the insight-enabled one. The key to this insight is to think about telemetry. We have talked about insight or instrumentation since a long time. I'm sure you have been aware of the various discussions for design for operations and stuff like that, which is very important. And we made a couple of announcements around DevOps this morning, which is another theme that you will see emerging. But when we talk about telemetry, we are really talking about operational behavior, yes, but also business behavior. Again, the shopping basket is the best example that makes sense for most of us because we have experienced it. It's really interesting to see how the users got there. So if you wanted to see how if your navigation principles of your website work, if your search engine work, tracking how the user got to the point where they got is an important piece. Then clicking and putting it into the shopping basket is a really important event. And you want to encourage the user either to continue shopping or close the transaction. Because I don't know if you know, but the statistics tell you that between 2 and 5% of purchases or people that are browsing a website actually buy. It's between 2 and 5%. And that's a really good number if you get to 5%. And what you want to figure out is, how do I analyze, collect information that's relevant, I analyze it in terms of real-time and historical analysis of event streams. So if you're going to look at sessions or for sessions, look for Stream Insight or .NET RX. Those are two great session types to look for real-time analytics. Stream Insight is part of SQL Server, and it allows you to set up a service-like thing to monitor and measure information events. And .NET RX is what I would call an embedded Stream Insight engine. It's a piece of code that you can inject into your own environment. consume, this part of the consumption is for people making sense out of the telemetry. So when you look at it, you have an application generating information. You feed it through a real-time environment, if you're that sophisticated already, then you dump it into a big data environment, Hadoop or PDW or something like it. You run analysis on it, and then some guy, some person, will have to make a decision what to do with that information. Do I, when I see somebody hovering in front of a shelf, do I send them a coupon? What kind of coupon do I send them? What do I want to entice? When I talked about MSN.com and the demographic models, what we want to do is customize the advertising. So there was somebody that made a decision of, A, first of all, what does this user behavior mean? And then what do I do about it? And that's what this guy is all about. There are some layers that you need to think about. Infrastructure, we will do pretty much the job for you. Our log files in various formats, and if you use AviCode for .NET, we will trace more stuff than you ever can use. We will start using it in the DevOps environment, the Visual Studio guys will talk about. The application environment, in terms of the application infrastructure, the software that supports it, business events, and then user events. And relating those four layers into interesting information is what this is all about. Characterizing signals, again, when you think about telemetry, you can think about a series of streaming events, you can think about discrete events, you can think about what is the access type? Am I pushing the information? Am I pulling the information from the client? How do I do this? If I have an Android device that's on a 2G network or 3G network, how much data can I actually push or pull across the wire for my own data behavior, because I still have to run the app, and the telemetry insight that I'm interested to collect to give better and more services to that user? How do I distinguish those things? Ambient active, Dave Campbell, I don't know if he's going to talk. He's now the CTO for the server and tools business. He said that he doesn't like the term big data because big data assumes that only large masses of information are interesting. He looks at big data as an ambient data. You don't know the value of the data if it's lots or not so much information. You look at it as ambient data. And so that's kind of what we're looking at here. Is it ambient data, telemetry, perf counters, and so forth, where you have to figure out what is it, what does it mean? Is it good or bad? And then active data, where you say, do something, because I'm about to break. There's lots of types like that. Sources of signals, we kind of talked about this. This is just some good information in terms of how do you trace them. If you go into the fail-safe discussion on the Windows Azure implementation, you will find a heck of a lot of information about telemetry. And the Windows Azure CAT team, the customer advisory team, has put a lot of guidance out, how do you do that? And they are very concrete, saying if you're building an Azure service and that is not telemetry enabled, don't deploy. And if you do deploy, here are the ways to get telemetry information, and log4net, et cetera, et cetera. So they give very, very concrete guidance for you. Consumer pattern, inform, react, explore. This is on the human side. So we are still moving information from the app to the human. And somebody has to make decisions what this information means and feeds it back into the form of quote-unquote a model. And the model that we are actually exploring here is what's called the monitor, mine, and manage pattern. The application creates events, information in some form, log files, events, etc. The events get pushed through a complex event processing engine. That's the real-time analytics that I've talked about before with Stream Insight and .NET RX. And effectively, you have a subset of the information that you have in your digital shoebox, Hadoop, etc., available and make decisions. Think about the MSN.com example, where I'm looking at user clicked A, B, C, went from main page to sports page to American football, the likelihood that that's a white male in a certain age bracket is very high because of the navigation pattern. If you go from the main page to the whatever lifestyle and horoscopes, not so clear. There might be some metrosexual people that do the same thing as a more female-oriented environment. Again, there's lots of demographic information available where you can make that kind of thing. And the event engine feeds events back to say, hey, the demographics that I deduced is blah. Application figure something out. And then effectively, the events also get pushed into what's called the digital shoebox. Digital shoebox because you don't change the schema. You don't do a transformation before you put it there. You just dump it. And then you effectively use various techniques. Again, if you've not played around with Hadoop or similar big data technologies, lots of sessions around big data here, take a look. And you're using Hive or Pig or machine learning to effectively understand the value of the data. Is there a correlation between a person going from main page to football, to sports, to American football? Is there a correlation? And what did the person do next? When they were there, they actually started to query for whatever, shaving cream or some other nonsense. So there is lots of data. You need to figure out how they correlate and how do they give you insight. And then you effectively generate a model. A model is simply something where you say, you see these three events, you see these patterns, you see this behavior, do something. And that gets fed back into the event engine, and that's a continuous loop. You effectively are doing this on a continuous basis. When I look at, I'm sure MSN.com's demographic model has been way more sophisticated than I describe it, and it's continuously evolving based upon external information, based upon our own behaviors that we are seeing, and we're changing the way the application sends advertising, demographic, and so forth around. Now I'm going the other way. Now I've done my model generation, I've put it into the event engine, and now what do I want to do? I want to collect information, same thing, I want to analyze it, and now I want to consume. I want to anticipate, accelerate, and alter. Let me go you through some of these ideas. Data fundamentals, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we are running out of time. But for me, I don't know, any of you being line of business application developers? Over there. Sorry if I offend you. I apologize up front. Those people, generally business apps people, including my Dynamics friends or the SAP guys, data is data. What are you talking about? Unfortunately, data is not equals data, and we do have to start thinking about data very, very differentiated, especially in the devices and services context, and especially in the insight context. Pat Helland, who used to work for Microsoft, wrote this wonderful article about data on the inside, data on the outside. He wrote it in the age of SOA, so ages ago, 2005 or 6. But it's still very, very relevant because it really describes data behaviors, data characteristics. It talks a lot about immutability and so forth. Again, reference data or master data, lots of people know about it. And that's something that you can cache really easily. Activity data, this is effectively data like the shopping basket. Shopping baskets are user-oriented. They are singular. You can share them. You can do them, move them around. And then there's the resource shared data, which is not that important. Messages is another type of data that's described. The reason why I'm putting it out is because you need to think about how you collect that data, what kind of data you collect, and how do you distribute it across the environment from services to applications, because insight doesn't have to run in a service. So when you go back to this monitor and mine pattern, one example which I was involved in was a company who is in the shipping business, and they are also providing tracking services for high-value goods. When you're putting a container on a boat, a big boat, it's really expensive to track in real time what's going on. But they bit the bullet, and they did the satellite phone thing, and blah, 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 put it on the container. And what they were interested in is everything running normal? Or is somebody opening the doors, or is the humidity changing, is water coming into the container, stuff like that. And so we developed effectively the same version of what I showed before, but locally. So we're running Stream Insight as a DLL, or now I would use .NET RX, and effectively I'm monitoring the behavior of the container. And only once in a while, every 5 minutes or so, instead of continuously opening a connection to the satellite, sending a heartbeat saying everything is okay. So we are monitoring effectively the good lines. There's good behavior here. In between, everything is cool. When you get over the line, we move over. So you can actually use that pattern not just in a distributed kind of devices are dumb, services are smart. You can also build some device smarts and real-time analytics into the device. So here are the three types of consuming insight from an application perspective that we have seen. First is inform. The demographic example is the best one. The real-time analytics engine says, hey, I found these behavior patterns. We think this is a male of this age with this income bracket. Application, take it or leave it. Or when you think about weather updates, a weather update is an information based upon smarts. I'm going to share this with you as a car. Hey, there's a storm coming. You might want to slow down. But you as a car navigation system, or MSN.com in this case, you need to take the decision what to do with that. So it's a good architecture design to let the real-time analytics system feed information back, but have the app decide what to do with it. Because, again, you don't necessarily know who's the consumer of that information. The next one is command and control. Remember the oil platform that I talked about, the oil rig? What the guys are really interested in is stuff happens, meaning they're going down thousands of meters, hot and cold and whatnot, varying surface conditions or undersurface conditions. And what they're really interested in is they want to stop the head from breaking before it actually breaks. That's what they're really interested in, because when it really breaks, it takes forever to get it back. And so it's very expensive and takes a long time. If they can stop it right before breaking, then they actually have a much shorter repair cycle and, of course, much cheaper. So I know that Shell and Chevron and lots of these guys effectively are employing a device and services pattern where they have sensors everywhere, and they have a .NET real-time analytics environment that effectively looks for, have we seen this before? Are we still okay? Are we still okay? And when they feel that the system gets towards the non-okay part, they send a command to the .NET station, the controller, stop right now. Same thing with the fracking machine and so forth, where they're looking at the app needing to know what they need to stop, but the real-time environment sending the command sequence over saying, stop right now. You're actually becoming in danger. The last one is a pet peeve of mine, is enhanced data. There are two types of data that we are seeing people enhancing with this pattern of monitoring, mining, and so forth. On the one side, you actually produce new data models like recommendations. I create recommendations based upon insight that I created. So user behavior, user purchases, et cetera, create a new type of data that wasn't really there before, which is recommendations. When you start a retail website, you can make recommendations up. Yep. You can say, Yuri is going to buy these things. But over time, you should effectively tune the data to say, actually, people like Yuri will actually do this kind of thing. If you're using SharePoint and you're using SharePoint 2013, you actually have one of those recommendation engines built into the product. And it will actually recommend things, for example, documents or sites or other things that you're interested in. So that pattern is being used by our products today between the search engine and the recommendation engine. The other thing that the recommendation engines typically do is effectively are changing your data, meaning their own index data. When you look at best bets, don't know if you're a social person, or if you are in the knowledge management business, you actually see when you search, Google, Bing, whatever, best bets are, do this. With the new SharePoint 2013 recommendation engine underneath, it will actually dynamically adjust the best bets based upon usage, not what you think best bets are. It actually will determine, nope, this best bet is actually no best bet because nobody clicked on it. Nobody ever clicked on it when they got this result served, so it must be wrong. And again, you have two modes where the system says, I can either change the data or I can inform the product manager saying, hey, your best bet sucks. It doesn't work. And so that's really what we are looking at in terms of how you consume the insight. My view, very simple, If you are building telemetry into your apps and so forth, that's all awesome. Feeding it into eventually a dashboard and Excel and whatever for analysis, absolutely necessary. But if you don't figure out a way to do something like it, it's really not that interesting. Because your code, your app, the service, and so forth should benefit from how you effectively learn about your user's behavior, what's going on, and so forth. So always think about how do you improve the user's behavior based upon the information and data that you gather. Social. Most of it I already talked about. Social taxonomy for the non-social people among us. I'm one of them, by the way. I have a Facebook account, but I only monitor my daughter's behavior. That's all I do on Facebook. So don't try to friend me. I'll accept LinkedIn environments, but Facebook I'm not that much into. But it is worth thinking through what are the social things your app wants to interact with and how do you want to interact with. When you're thinking about social, you always have to think about the social contract, meaning if you want somebody's access to somebody's graph and it's not an enterprise app or a consumer app, you have to give this guy something so that they'll do it. So the coupon example is a perfect social application because the user opted in to say, hey, I'll get coupons for sharing, for example, my geolocation in the store with you. So I will effectively have a deal with you. That's a lot of how social behavior works. And then thinking through how you effectively interact with these various types. And good news is that the enterprise social fabric, be it SharePoint plus Yammer or other opportunities or other products, actually allow you to do something similar like you can do today with Twitter or Facebook and so forth. So it doesn't have to go public. It actually can stay quite into the enterprise, which of course can include your trading partners as well. We already talked about the adapting the application experience, the power of the graph. So that's effectively how you use the graph to customize and personalize your application's behavior based upon what you find in that graph. Open Graph Protocol, and it is a very, very simple protocol. If you go to yammer.com/developer, you will find a lot of very simple JavaScript code of how you enable that kind of thing in an environment like a web page. You can also implement it in C# if you're into that kind of environment. It's based on RDFA. And it's effectively a set of meta tags that you put together. The thing that I actually want to recommend to you doesn't mean it's something that you should take as a gospel, but certainly something to think about. The SharePoint guys are effectively in 2013 the first enterprise social environment, now enhanced with Yammer. And they really standardize on three verbs: share, like, and follow. And it would be really important, and again, I'm working on the next level down in terms of what does it mean to share? Where do you share to? Because there's a gazillion options, of course, because social fabrics are configurable. So what does it mean to share? When you, as an app, let's say like CRM, the original example I used, you want to share the sales order status. Are you sharing this as a newsfeed? Are you sharing it into a Yammer group? What are you going to do? Because that's kind of where we are today. Like, simple thing, I like this one. How do you share it? And how do you consume that liking back into your app, and what does that mean? If somebody likes the status of your sales order, do you care? Most of the time you might not, but sometimes you might, saying, ha, actually my sales manager just approved it because he likes my order. Could that be the implied protocol? I don't know. And follow the same thing. Follow most likely will be a newsfeed kind of thing because you will get updates depending on where you are in an email form RSS feed or in a newsfeed, what's going on with that app while it's being processed by CRM or by the ERP system. But regardless what you decide to do, it's really important before you start socially enabling your app to determine what that means. Because as I said before, implicit protocols or implicit agreements are not that good. Like, my boss liking my order, meaning approving it, I'm not so sure that that's the right model, but you could consume it that way. It's just important to have a strategy and a policy. Somebody likes builds, I don't, but at least it's an automatic build. Just a summary of what we talked about, and then recap. Important is that devices and services as a Microsoft strategy is not Windows-centric. It is Windows-optimized, meaning if the devices are Windows, you will get a richer and better experience with more stuff. If you're using Apple or Android devices, you will get a great experience as well. It's not quite the same, but it's very, very much enabled. And we want you to think about a Microsoft devices and services strategy as an encompassing strategy. Also, services don't have to run on Windows Azure. They can run on-premise, they can run on AWS, as long as we look at how you integrate them together and follow, for example, the principles I outlined. We believe that devices and services give us enough opportunity all up as an industry that we can make a ton of interesting scenarios happening and ideally earn a little bit of money along the way together. With that, I'm actually 13 seconds shy. I have two reminders to give you. Please evaluate the session, so share your opinions, how you think the expectation we set in the announcement and what I delivered worked or not. And I read all of those comments, so anything you share with me, more than happy to follow up on or improve the next time if we see each other again. With that, I really want to thank you for your patience and interest, and enjoy the rest of the week in New Orleans. Don't get lost. It's dangerous out here.